Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have three cases on our oral argument docket this afternoon, and we have three different panels sitting. So we will hear the first case, and then we will take a brief recess to switch panels and proceed with the second case, and switch panels and proceed with the third case. And if our clerk will please call the case, we will begin. Gilstrap.
May it please the court. Article 1, Section 17 of the Texas Constitution, a city may not take private property for public use without paying adequate compensation. Article 1, Section 19 guarantees the property owner due process in that proceeding and allows him injunctive relief to enforce due process. But what if the building is substandard? What if it's in disrepair? The cases call this a nuisance, although I don't think it actually conforms to a nuisance, the common law nuisance definition, but they use the term. What if it's a nuisance? Well, in those cases, the city can knock the building down because it's not worth anything and it doesn't have to pay adequate compensation. It still has to pay for the land, so it can knock down the bricks and mortar, but it has to pay for the dirt. Also, the courts have held that the states can impose administrative procedures to determine whether property is a nuisance and what the remedy is. In Texas, we have two statutes, and these are the subjects of a bench exhibit that's before you today. And I'm not going to ask you to look at it this time, but it's a three-page bench exhibit that has excerpts from Chapter 54 of the Local Government Code and Chapter 214 of the Local Government Code. And those are the ones that permit a city to impose an administrative procedure for nuisance abatement by ordinance. They're somewhat different. Under Chapter 54, in both cases, the initial determination is made by a city official. In Chapter 54, you have a Building Standards Commission, which is kind of like ZBA. They're appointed members. They hear the evidence sitting in panels, and they make the determination. The remedies are fairly limited. They can either order you to repair it or to knock it down, but they can impose a fine. Chapter 214 is different. There, the administrative determination is made by the municipal judge. And he has a broad range of discretion. He can give the property owner more time. He can impose a bond. I believe the city also gets a lien under that statute, but he cannot impose a fine, and that's a crucial difference. Now, under both statutes, once a determination is made, the property owner has 30 days to appeal by filing suit in district court. And the statutes say that the district court makes a determination under the substantial evidence rule. But in City of Dallas versus Stewart, the Texas Supreme Court said, no, it's got to be trial de novo. We're taking property, and in the end, the determination as to whether to take a private citizen's property has got to be made by a district judge, not by a city official. Okay, in this proceeding, our predecessor, New York Avenue LLC, owned the apartments. The city began an abatement proceeding against them. And on February 15, 2013, the municipal judge signed a, quote, final judgment. Well, it wasn't a final judgment, but it was called that. And it gave the city the discretion to order the city, the buildings repaired, removed, or demolished, or to impose a $1,000 a day fine, which they can't do under Chapter 214, even though they say they're proceeding under 214. Later, in August, the court entered a, quote, order authorizing demolition. Well, that's misleadingly titled. It didn't order demolition. It gave a municipal official, I think the assistant director of code compliance, the authority to decide whether to order the buildings demolished or to impose a fine. We weren't on the scene, and we concede that we did not file any suit within 30 days of any of these orders. And the city is saying that therefore we're out of court. What happened was we came in, we negotiated with the city, because in these cases the cities really don't want to knock down the buildings. They either want to get somebody, they either want to get them fixed, or they want to have somebody else come in and fix them. And we thought we had a good chance. We acquired the property through foreclosure. We came in, negotiated with the city. We offered, there was evidence that it was cost $1.7 million to repair the apartments. We offered to put up a $2 million bond we were going to find. Suddenly the city changes course. Well, we've got a new plan for this area, the New York Avenue Corridor Plan, and these are going to be townhomes, and you can't fix the apartments. They took control of our property, they fenced it, they kicked the tenants out, and they won't even let us on premises to inspect it or make repairs. Now, we file suit. Trial court grants a plea of the jurisdiction. In this proceeding, you can only do one of two things, affirm or reverse. You can't, that's as far as you can go in a plea of the jurisdiction proceeding. And they say, you know, we didn't meet the 30-day deadline. But there's a difference in approach here that's very important. They say that we didn't meet the 30-day deadline, therefore they're immune. The city is not immune. We can sue for inverse condemnation under Article 1, Section 17. Everybody knows the city is not immune from a suit for inverse condemnation. The better argument for them is not that they're immune, but that we fail to exhaust our administrative remedies. That's the issue before us. So you've got to look at it and say, well, gosh, you didn't do it within 30 days. Why did you fail to exhaust your administrative remedies? Well, the reason is because the statute is not applicable. They were not proceeding under Chapter 214 or under Chapter 54. They had been proceeding under Chapter 54, they would have had the Building Standards Commission make the determination. They didn't. They had the municipal judge. And if they were proceeding under Chapter 214, they wouldn't have imposed a fine. But they did. Or at least gave the city discretion to have a fine.
Isn't that something you would have had to appeal within 30 days?
What's that?
Isn't that something that you would have to have raised within 30 days, not in some constitutional takings lawsuit filed years later?
Well, it wasn't years, but we were late. I concede that point. If the statute had been applicable, we would. We would be out of court under failure to exhaust, although let me say that the courts have never been clear as to whether failure to exhaust is jurisdictional or merely an administrative prerequisite or a statutory prerequisite. That issue is still floating out there, but either way, we would lose. It's just determined, you know, if it were not it didn't give rise to immunity, you would just send it back to the court, and the court would say you didn't meet the statutory prerequisite, and you lose. But let me get to your question. The statute is not applicable. Why? Because it allowed the city to impose a fine. Moreover, they say they're not clear as to what statute they're proceeding under. Final judgment says that they're proceeding under Chapter 14 or other relevant law, whatever that is. The fact is that what they've imposed here is a homegrown, bastardized procedure. It picks and chooses. Oh, well, we don't want to give up the fine. We're going to put that in. And yet, we don't want to give up the streamlined procedure under 214. We're going to put that in, too, and the bond under 214, which they collected a bond, $150,000 bond. So, under those circumstances, there are two questions before you. First of all, can the city impose this type of hybrid procedure? That's a deep question. You know, I think you get into the question of the issue of what the city can do under the home rule provision. Can it concoct its own ordinance that allows an administrative procedure that doesn't conform to either one of the statutorily mandated procedures? That's a hard question. But the easy question is this. Their ordinance does not provide a 30-day provision. It only comes from the statute, and the statute is not applicable. Let me get you to look at the statute. That's in the bench exhibit, which is before you, and it's on page 3. And there, under 214.0012, an owner aggrieved by an order of a municipality issued under chapter 214 may appeal within 30 days. This is not an order of a municipality issued under chapter 214. It's an order of a municipality issued under its own homegrown ordinance. Now, am I being legalistic? No. No, the city is being legalistic. They say, oh my goodness, you know, we've got this. You didn't meet 214. You failed to jump through all the hoops, and therefore you lose. Our response is, you didn't apply chapter 214. How can you apply chapter 214 when part and parcel of the remedy is that they can impose a fine? And it's not just something the municipal judge did. It's in the ordinance. In page section 1605 D5, page 106 of the clerk's record, it says the hearing authority, that's the municipal judge, shall order a civil penalty that the city may assess if the owner fails to repair, remove, or demolish the building in accordance with the order. It shall not exceed $1,000 per day. That's not in the statute. That's in chapter 54. Moreover, the next page, or on page 108 of the clerk's record, section 1606D, it mandates that the city judge and the municipal judge shall sign an order which says exactly what the order said here, that the city is authorized its discretion to vacate, secure, repair, remove, or demolish the building at its own expense, which it can do under chapter 214. Alternatively, the city is authorized to assess a civil penalty on the owner in the amount of so-and-so. That's exactly what he did. He didn't go off the reservation. He followed the statute, followed the ordinance. How can they impose the requirements of section 214, the technical requirement that we file suit within 30 days, when they themselves are not following the statute? That's the question before you. I think that's all I have at this point.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
I've been listening to your presentation about how these two statutes are the authorizing provisions in the state law. But I didn't hear you address the questions that were raised and ruled on by the Supreme Court in the Beaumont against Como case. And I'm working in my mind how you get around the Como case from what you just said on your opening argument. And I want to ask you if it's your position that what you're doing is saying you didn't follow the statutes and therefore you don't even have a good scheme for which there has to be an exhaustion of administrative remedies.
Right. Well, the court probably needs to reacquaint me with exactly what you're talking about out of the city of Como. I've read the statute, but I don't know exactly what you mean.
I'm talking about the parts that's in the subtitles 1, 2, and 3 where the court's announcing its decision and providing that a party must also avail herself of statutory remedies that may moot her takings claim rather than directly institute a separate proceeding asserting such a claim. In other words, she didn't, in this case, Ms. Como didn't even get into any appeal. She didn't even attend the hearing. She didn't do anything. And so what the Supreme Court says is, well, if you're going to be so flippant about what you're doing while we're going through the hearing process or we're going through the valuation and you don't appeal to the district court, you're not going to be able to come. You can't come in here and start a constitutional Article 117.19 claim.
Well, Justice Meyer, I don't think that Como turns the fact that the guy didn't show up. You know, I think it turns on the fact that he didn't meet the statutory prerequisite to file within 30 days.
Yes, I agree with that.
That assumes that the statutory prerequisite is applicable. If it's not applicable, we don't have to meet it.
Okay, I follow your logic.
All right. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. Three Texas Supreme Court cases hold that Judge Sutterith properly granted the city's plea to the jurisdiction in this case. The City of Dallas versus Stewart case, the Patel versus City of Everman case, which came out of this court and was affirmed by the Supreme Court, and the City of Beaumont versus Como that Justice Meyer mentioned, hold that challenges to a nuisance determination must be made by filing a timely appeal to district court, and that any constitutional challenges must be made at that time as well. Those cases further hold that if a timely appeal is not taken, those claims are lost forever. And that is precisely what happened here. Now, undoubtedly recognizing that it faces an uphill battle with this line of cases, 1707's made a number of arguments. The one I heard today is completely new, and it's not even in their brief. And that is that somehow the city's process was defective because it wasn't following the statute. But if you look in the record, that's not what 1707 has admitted. In fact, they admitted very clearly that the nuisance determination was right and that there was no basis to attack the nuisance determination or the judgment itself. And that's in the 352nd court record. Recall that the case was transferred. That's for reporters record 14. Now in its brief, 1707 argues that it's suing for conduct of the city that occurred after the judgment was final. And it outlines four claims that are not in its petition that it says support that. But of course, to evaluate a party's claims, we don't look to their briefs, we look to their petition. And the petition that 1707 filed is abundantly clear in its attack on the final judgment. That is solely the basis of that petition. How do we know? Well, the final judgment is the first exhibit to the petition. If this case has nothing to do with the final judgment, why would you attach it at all? And if this case has nothing to do with the final judgment and the administrative process, why are they suing for just compensation for defendants taking the apartments, for unconstitutional deprivation of plaintiff's rights in the property, for refusing to allow the plaintiff to rehab the property, to keep the city from destroying and demolishing the apartment buildings? And how come in paragraph 5.06 have they pled an entire cause of action that the municipal court judgment is unconstitutional? The allegations in the petition, which Judge Sutterith properly dismissed, attack the final judgment, and it's too late to do that under Como, Patel, and Stewart. The same goes for the new claims on page 18 of the brief. In claim one, they argue that the final judgment gave the city discretion to demolish, which incidentally is at odds with what they're saying today, and that the city didn't exercise that discretion well. But, of course, the judgment was final, and the city was able to use whatever discretion it afforded to it to abate the property. In claim two, they argue that the city fenced the apartments, but the final judgment expressly allows the property to be secured so it can be abated. Claim three is the city should have allowed 1707 to rehab the property. Of course, the final judgment gives 1707 no such right. And then lastly, they argue that when the city demolishes the apartments, it must show that the apartments are a nuisance on the date of demolition. That's not the case either. The property had already been deemed a nuisance and are forever a nuisance because an appeal was not had. In the City of El Paso versus Fox, this is out of the El Paso Court of Appeals, 458 Southwest 3rd, 56, the same arguments were made that are in 1707's brief. That is, we're suing not to attack a final or previous judgment, but because you won't let us rehabilitate the property. The Court of Appeals said no. That's not right. Your claims effectively seek judicial review of the condemnation order, and they're improper for the same reasons the Stewart, Patel, and Como courts dismissed the plaintiff's claims in those cases. Now, I want to address Mr. Gilstrap's argument about exhaustion versus governmental immunity and whether the trial court properly dismissed the case on governmental immunity grounds. And they argue that we've improperly characterized it, that it's exhaustion, it's not governmental immunity. And I think they misunderstand the point. Rather than it being one or the other, it's cause and effect. Because they didn't exhaust, they've lost their right to bring the claim. And therefore, the city is immune from suit. And that's what happened in the Como case, incidentally. It's a plea to the jurisdiction that was granted based on governmental immunity. The exact same grounds the city won in the trial court in this case. In City of Dallas versus VSC, the Texas Supreme Court addressed the argument that there is permanent waiver for a taking in the Constitution. There's always waiver of governmental immunity with respect to a taking. The Supreme Court in that case said that's not true. The Constitution, indeed, grants waiver of governmental immunity for a takings claim. But the legislature also has very broad authority to prescribe administrative procedures that are required to be followed in order continue to be waived. And in BSC, the court said, if you don't avail yourself of those, you lose the right. That's exactly what happened in this case. That's all I have, unless the panel has questions for me.
Mr. Arnett, address the proposition that Mr. Gilstrap advanced, that the action taken here by the municipal court fails to comply with either of the two authorizing sections of the code whereby this kind of trend of approach can be taken by a city.
Yes, Justice Meyer. As a preliminary matter, I'll note that I've never heard this argument before and it's not in the briefs, but I will respond and I do believe I know the answer. The process that was followed was the exact procedure set out by Section 214, because the city's building code that applied adopts 214 word for word. I believe it says that in its opening paragraph. So it certainly was followed. Moreover, if they had a problem with the proceeding, any due process complaints or arguments or complaints that the statute was not followed, that had to be asserted in their appeal. Their time to challenge the process was in a timely appeal filed within 30 days of the conclusion of the DSS proceeding, and that did not occur, and they can't do that now.
If the city's goal in working on cleaning up properties that are a public nuisance is to improve the city and the atmosphere, the environment, let's have a better place to live, get these old substandard structures out of the way. If that's the goal, and then if the circumstances developed in this case where the new owner came in and was willing to put up a $2 million escrow, sought the city's input on what needs to be done, proposes a detailed plan on how to bring things up to code, yet the city here wasn't working to, wasn't interested in doing those things, but instead had a different plan and a different use with a different common zoning plan or common development plan for the land on which the La Jolla apartments stood. I'm not following how that all fits exactly, but for the fact that the city's interested in doing a different kind of development on New York Avenue.
Your Honor, the New York Avenue plan had nothing to do with the original condemnation of this property. This property had literally thousands of code violations prior to the time that the DSS proceeding was brought against it. And the DSS proceeding lasted 6 months literally 6 months, and the owner at the time was allowed multiple opportunities to go back and correct, fix, remediate, and all that, and ultimately failed to do so. And the court said, you've lost your right. It's now going to be abated. But with respect to those meetings that 1707 has complained about, where I guess they've asserted that we were sort of led to believe that we have a chance, that maybe you're going to let us remediate this property. At that time, the judgment was final. It had not been released. So those discussions were mere negotiations that did not result in a contract or any agreement. And as this court held, and I believe it's the Scribner case, negotiations cannot form the basis of a constitutional claim. You can't do it. Now, had there been a settlement agreement that the city had entered into with them that released the final judgment, they could enforce that. That did not occur.
You contend, and I think this is the way I read your briefing, that the final judgment date was August the 13th of 2013?
Yes, Your Honor.
Everything that happened after that didn't matter because we were really just kind of talking to you because we really got in our pocket a final judgment we're going to enforce.
It's not that it didn't matter. The city sat down with the owner of the property and listened to their plan, and their plan did not even abate asbestos, which was one of the biggest concerns in the final judgment. It's specifically required to be abated, and they didn't even come with a plan to do that. So the discussions broke down, and the city determined that this buyer did not have the ability or was not willing to do what it was going to take to bring this property to a safe level. But another thing I'll point out, 1707, the plaintiff in this case, had not even been organized as an entity under the laws of the state of Texas at the time of any of these meetings on which this claim is based. And in fact, in the record, you'll see, if you look at both parties' briefs, and I believe it's on pages 5 and 6 of ours and page 9 of theirs, the city unequivocally informed 1707 it was going to proceed with demolition before 1707 ever acquired the property. So it was told demolition was going to go forward, and it nevertheless acquired the property. And it didn't acquire the property until January of 2014, I believe. So I think they've got the wrong plaintiff, but the record also shows that there were meetings and legitimate reasons why this proposal they made was not adequate.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Arnett.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Gilstrap?
Well, let me talk about the waiver issue. Might have a problem, except that this is an appeal from the denial of a plea to the jurisdiction. And I will submit to you a broad provision. We don't have to get this broad. There can't be a waiver as to jurisdiction. Courts haven't ever exactly said that, but I can't ever find a case where they said, oh, well, you waived your jurisdictional argument. In fact, we could be going up there, you know, this could be an appeal from the trial on the merits, and the city could come in here and say, oh, no jurisdiction. It could be raised at that time. Our argument that the court has jurisdiction can be raised at that at any time. Now, he is correct that in Reporter's Record 14, we made an inconsistent argument. That's in our motion for rehearing. Judge Sutterth denied the motion. And we dropped it. You know, you don't get penalized you get penalized when a court, you make an inconsistent argument and the court adopts it. That's judicial estoppel. When you make an inconsistent argument and you lose, you learn and you go on down the road. That's what happened here. Insofar as the timing, we say that the final judgment was in October when the building official finally said, well, we're going to go ahead and demolish the building. Now that doesn't save us on the 30-day rule, but it does correct the record. Insofar as what's in our petition, this court is not deciding the claims that are in the petition. It can certainly look at the claims in determining whether and engaging in its jurisdictional analysis. But the cases on plea of the jurisdiction are very clear. If we can amend, you can't grant the plea of the jurisdiction. And they're not saying we can't amend. They're saying that somehow our claims are somehow inconsistent with our timing question. At the end of the day, all we want is our day in court. The city hasn't followed the law. And then they stand up and say, oh my goodness, you lose your day in court because you haven't followed the law. The proper ruling is that the city did not proceed under either one of the statutes. Therefore, the 30-day provisions which are in the statutes cannot be applicable. And we can do what we could always do before the statutes were enacted. We can ask the court to review the administrative determination by filing suit. And it is clear, and we've got some cases cited in our brief, that if there is no statute applicable, we have a constitutional right to have that ruling reviewed. And under Stewart, we have a right to have it reviewed in a trial de novo. That's what we're asking. Thank you very much.
Mr. Gilstrap, Mr. Arnett, thank you very much for your arguments here today. They've been very helpful, as well as your briefing, which was excellent. We appreciate that. We will stand in recess for a few minutes for a panel change and to give the lawyers in the other case a chance to get set up. Thank you, gentlemen.